Now, regarding the matters you wrote to me about, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of fornications, each man should have his own wife, and each woman should have her own husband. After addressing the three most serious accusations against them, namely causing division in the church, tolerating a sexual offender, and condoning greed, he transitions to a gentler tone of speech. He includes some discussion and advice about marriage and virginity, offering listeners a break from more difficult subjects. However, in the second letter, he reverses the order. He begins with less severe topics and concludes with the more distressing ones. Here too, once he wraps up his dialogue on virginity, he dives back into topics more related to reproof. He doesn't maintain a strict structure, but alternates his content based on need and the urgency of the issues at stake. Therefore, he states, "Now about the matters you've written to me." Because they had written to him asking, "Is it appropriate to abstain from one's wife or not?" And in response to this, and providing guidelines about marriage, he also introduces the discussion about virginity. "It is good for a man not to touch a woman. For if," he says, "you inquire about what is the outstanding and highly superior path, it's better not to have any relationship at all with a woman. But if you inquire about what is safe and beneficial to your own weakness, be united by marriage." But as it often happens, even now, that a husband might be willing but the wife not, or perhaps the opposite, notice how he discusses each scenario. Some indeed suggest that this discourse was specifically aimed at priests. But I, drawing from what follows, could not confidently say that this was the case, since he wouldn't have given his general advice. If he were writing these things only for the priests, he would have said, "It is good for the teacher not to touch a woman." But now he's made it universally applicable, stating, "It is good for a man, not for a priest only." And again, "Are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife?" He didn't specify, "You who are a priest and a teacher," but left it indefinite. His whole speech consistently remains in the same tone. And when saying, "Because of sexual immorality, let every man have his own wife," by mentioning the very cause for the concession, he guides men towards self-control. Let the husband give the wife the respect she deserves. Similarly, the wife should give the same respect to her husband. So when you see a prostitute tempting you, say, "My body is not mine, but my wife's." Similarly, a woman should say to those who would threaten her chastity, "My body is not mine, but my husband's." Now, if neither husband nor wife has power even over their own body, much less do they over their property. Listen, all who have husbands and all who have wives, if you must not consider your body your own, much less your money. I agree that elsewhere he accords the husband significant superiority, both in the New Testament and the Old, stating, "Your commitment shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you." Even Paul follows this by drawing a distinction and writing, "Husbands, love your wives, and let the wife ensure she respects her husband." But in this context, we're no longer dealing with greater or lesser. Rather, it's about equal rights. Why is this so? Because his sermon was about chastity. In all other things, he says, let the husband have the upper hand, but not when the matter pertains to chastity. The husband doesn't have authority over his own body, nor does the wife. There exists a strong similarity of honor with no superiority. Do not cheat each other unless it is with mutual consent. What then does this imply? Do not practice abstinence, he says, if the husband doesn't agree, nor the husband without the wife's consent. Why is this so? Because significant problems come from this sort of abstinence, for adulteries, fornications, and the destruction of families have often arisen from this. For if men commit fornication even when they have their own wives, they are more likely to do so if you deny them of this comfort. And rightly does he say, do not deny, denial here and debt earlier, to emphasize the seriousness of the right of power in question. For practicing abstinence against the will of the other is denying, but not when it's with the other's consent, just as I wouldn't consider myself denied if you take something of mine after persuading me. Denial only occurs when someone takes something against another's will and by force, a situation which many women create, committing sin rather than righteousness, and thereby becoming responsible for their husband's uncleanliness and dividing everything. They should value unity above everything else, since this is more crucial than all else. We will, if you agree, look at it in terms of actual scenarios. Let's imagine a husband and wife, and let's say the wife practices abstinence without the consent of her husband. Now, if as a result he commits fornication, or even if he refrains from it but ends up getting agitated, restless, argumentative, and causes all sorts of problems to his wife, where is the benefit of the fasting and the abstinence when it disrupts love? There is none. Because it will certainly lead to vexing accusations, a sea of troubles, initiating a great dispute. After all, when a husband and wife are in conflict, their home will be as chaotic as a ship caught in a storm, especially if the master is at odds with his first mate. This is why the saying goes, "Do not deprive each other unless by mutual consent for a period of time for you to focus on prayer." The prayer being referred to here is one of exceptional fervor. If the intention is to prohibit those who are intimate from praying, the phrase "pray without stopping" wouldn't make sense. So it is indeed possible to be with your spouse and still dedicate yourself to prayer. However, through abstinence, prayer can be made more perfect. The phrasing of "that you may give yourselves to it" suggests that the practice won't cause impurity, but rather preoccupation. And maybe together again, so that Satan does not tempt you. That's why, so it doesn't seem like a clear rule, he clarifies the reasoning. And what is it? So that Satan does not tempt you. And so you understand that it's not just the devil causing this crime, namely adultery, he adds, due to your lack of self-control. But I say this by allowance, not by order. For I wish that all people were like I am, in a state of self-control. He does this in many locations when he is advising on challenging issues. He presents himself as an example and says, "Consider me your model." However, each man has his own gift from God, some in one way and others in another. Since he previously warned them about their lack of self-control, he now comforts them by saying, "Each one has his own gift of God," not suggesting that there's no need for our effort towards that virtue, but rather, as I said earlier, to comfort them. For if it's a gift, and man contributes nothing towards it, how can you say, "But V8, I advise the unmarried and widows that it's good for them to remain as I am, V9, but if they lack self-control, let them marry"? Can you see Paul's profound understanding as he both indicates that self-control is better, yet doesn't force it upon those who can't achieve it, fearing that it may lead to some offense? "For it is better to marry than to burn." He highlights how strong the domination of desire is. What he's implying is something like this. If you have to endure a lot of pressure and burning desire, remove yourself from your pain and struggles. Otherwise, you might be overthrown. "But to the married I give instruction, yet not I, but the Lord." Because this is a law specifically outlined by Christ, which he is about to explain to them about the not divorcing a wife without adultery. Hence he says, "Not I." It is true what was previously mentioned, even if it wasn't specifically stated, it is also his decree. But this, you see, he had conveyed in clear words. Therefore, the phrases "I" and "not I" have this difference of meaning, so that you wouldn't think even his own words to be merely human. That's why he added, "For I believe that I also possess the Spirit of God." So, what is it that the Lord commanded for the married? That the wife should not leave her husband. However, if she does leave, let her stay unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Here, considering that both for the sake of continence and other reasons, and because of frail temperaments, it happens that separations occur. It would be better, he says, if such things didn't happen at all. But if they do happen, let the wife stay with her husband, if not to live with him, then at least not to bring any other man to be her husband. But I'm addressing the rest, not the Lord. If any man has a wife who doesn't believe and she is willing to live with him, he should not leave her. And if any woman has a husband who doesn't believe and he is willing to live with her, she should not leave him. As when discussing the separation from fornicators, he simply managed the matter by amending his words, saying, "However, not completely with the fornicators of this world." Likewise, in this scenario, he ensures for the ample ease of the duty, saying, "If any wife has a husband or husband a wife who doesn't believe, let him not leave her." What are you saying? If he is an unbeliever, let him stay with the wife, but not if he is a fornicator. And yet fornication is a lesser sin than unbelief. I agree. Fornication is a lesser sin, but God greatly tolerates your weaknesses. He does the same thing concerning the sacrifice, saying, "Leave the sacrifice and make peace with your brother." This is also the case with the man who owed tens of thousands of talents. He did not punish him for owing him tens of thousands of talents, but for demanding back 100 pence from his fellow servant, he exacted retribution on him. Then, to ease the woman's possible worry that she might become tainted through intimacy with her husband, he says, "For the unbelieving husband is made holy through the wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through the husband." Yet if he who unites with a prostitute becomes one body with her, it's quite obvious that a woman who merges with an idol worshipper also becomes one body with him. Yes, it is one body. Still, she does not become tainted, but the purity of the wife surpasses the impurity of the husband, and again, the purity of the believing husband surpasses the impurity of the unbelieving wife. So then, how does one overcome this impurity in this scenario, allowing for the relationship to continue, while in the case of a woman selling herself, her husband is justified in disowning her? This is because in this scenario, there is hope that the straying individual may still be rescued through the union in marriage. However, in the other case, the marital union has already been irreversibly damaged. Furthermore, in that case, both parties are defiled, while here the transgression lies with only one party. Here's what I mean. The woman who has participated in acts of immorality is completely repugnant. If then, he who unites himself with a prostitute becomes one with her, he also becomes repugnant by interacting with a prostitute, hence all purity disappears. But the situation we are discussing is not the same. How exactly? The one who worships idols is impure, but his wife is not. If indeed she were involved in his impurity, which is his godlessness, she would indeed be contaminated as well. But now, the idolater is defiled in one way, and his wife in another, wherein he's not impure. The shared experience in their case lies in the bond of matrimony and the physical union. Again, there is hope that this man may be turned around by his wife because she is entirely his, but for the other, it is not very easy. For how will she who disrespected him in the past and became someone else's and ruined the marriage rites have power to win back him whom she had wronged, him, furthermore, who still remains to her as a stranger? Again, in this case, after the adultery, the husband is no longer a husband. However, in this instance, even though the wife is an idolatress, the husband's rights are not harmed. However, he doesn't simply suggest living together with the unbeliever, but with the stipulation that he agrees to it. That's why he said, "And he himself be content to dwell with her. For tell me, what's the harm if the duties of piety remain intact, and there are good prospects regarding the unbeliever, that those already united should continue as such and not introduce reasons for unnecessary conflict? For the issue now is not about those who have never been together, but about those who are already together." He didn't say, "if anyone wishes to marry an unbelieving wife," but "if anyone has an unbelieving wife." This means, if anyone after getting married or being married have accepted the word of godliness, and then the other half, who has remained in unbelief, still longs to live together, the marriage should not be ended. For, he says, the unbelieving husband is sanctified through the wife. This shows the great abundance of your purity. So is the Greek holy? Definitely not, because he didn't say he is holy, but rather he is sanctified through his wife. He said this not to imply that the man is holy, but to alleviate the woman's fear as much as possible and inspire the man to pursue truth. Because the uncleanliness does not lie in the bodies sharing communion, but rather in the mind and thoughts. And here is the evidence. If you, being unclean, have a child, the child would not fully originate from you and would hence be unclean or partially clean. But now, that's not the case. To clarify, he added, otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy, meaning not unclean. But the apostle refers to them as holy, intensifying the phrase to eliminate fear stemming from such doubt. Verse 15. However, if the unbeliever decides to leave, let them leave. As in this context, it's no longer about sexual immorality. But what does it mean when it says, if the unbeliever departs? For instance, if they are trying to make you participate in their ungodliness because of your marriage, and if not, leave, it would be better to end the marriage than to compromise your godliness. Thus, he adds, a brother or a sister is not bound in such circumstances. If they continually torment you and create conflicts over this, it's better to separate. For this is what he implies, saying, but God has called us to live in peace. For it's the other person who has created a cause for separation, just like the one who committed sexual sin.
For how do you know, wife, if you will save your husband? This again relates to the phrase, don't leave him. What it means is, if he's not causing trouble, stay, he says, because there's even a benefit in that. Stay and advise and suggest and convince. Because no teacher will have as much influence to persuade as a wife does. And on one hand, he's not placing any obligation on her or demanding that she must do it so as not to cause her any distress. However, on the other hand, he's not telling her to lose hope either, but he keeps the situation uncertain because of the unknown future, saying, for how do you know, wife, if you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And further, verse 17, just as God has assigned to each person, as the Lord has called each, so should they continue to live. Was anyone called after being circumcised? They should not reverse it. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? They should not get circumcised. Circumcision and uncircumcision are meaningless. What matters is keeping God's commandments. Everyone should remain in the situation in which they were called. Were you called while being a slave? Don't worry about it. These things have no bearing on faith, he says, so don't argue or be upset, for faith has eliminated all these differences. Let each man remain in the situation he was in when he was called. Were you called while married to an unbelieving wife? Continue to be with her. Do not leave your wife because of your faith. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't worry about it. Continue as a slave. Were you uncircumcised when you were called? Stay uncircumcised. If you were circumcised, did you become a believer? Then stay circumcised. This is what it means when it says, as God has assigned each one. These are not obstacles to piety. You were called as a slave, another with an unbelieving wife, another being circumcised. Astonishing! Where has he placed slavery? As circumcision does not profit, and uncircumcision does no harm, so neither does slavery nor yet liberty. And to highlight this with exceptional clarity, he says, but even if you can become free, use it rather, that is, rather continue as a slave. Now, why on earth does he instruct the person who could possibly be set free to remain a slave? He intends to demonstrate that slavery is not harmful, but rather advantageous. Now, we are not oblivious to the fact that some interpret the phrase, use it rather, as referring to liberty, interpreting it as, if you can become free, become free. However, this interpretation would be in stark contrast to Paul's usual manner if that was his intention. Since he would not, while comforting the slave and indicating that they were not harmed in any way, have advised them to seek freedom. As perhaps someone might argue, what then if I can't? I'm a harmed and humiliated individual. This, then, is not what he's implying. Instead, as I've mentioned, suggesting that a person gains nothing by being set free, he's saying, even if you can achieve freedom, it's better to remain a slave. Next, he also explains the reason. For he who was called by the Lord as a servant is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he who was called as a free man is Christ's servant. For, he says, in matters concerning Christ, both are equal. Just as you are a servant of Christ, so is your master. So how then is the servant a free man? Because he has freed you not only from sin, but also from physical servitude while remaining a servant. For he does not allow the servant to remain a servant, even if he is a man living in servitude. And this is the great wonder. But how is the servant a free man while remaining a servant, when he is liberated from emotions and mental ailments, when he disregards wealth and anger and all other similar emotions? Verse 23. You were bought with a price. Don't become slaves of men. This statement is addressed not only to slaves, but also to free men. For it is possible for one who is a slave not to be a slave, and for one who is a free man to be a slave. And how can one be a slave and not a slave? When he does all for God, when he pretends nothing and does nothing for the mere approval of men. That's how one that is a slave to men can be free. Or again, how does one that is free become a slave? When he serves men in any wicked service, either for gluttony or desire of wealth or for the sake of office. For such a person, even if he is free, is more of a slave than any man. And reflect on these two points. Joseph was enslaved, but he wasn't a slave to men. For even in slavery, he was more free than all those who are free. For example, he did not surrender to his mistress, did not give in to the desires of the woman who owned him. On the other hand, she was free. Yet no one was as much a slave as her, wooing and pleading with her own servant. But she could not convince him who was free to do what he did not want to do. This, then, was not slavery, but it was a freedom of the highest kind. For what obstacle to virtue did he have from his slavery? Let all hear, both slaves and the free. Who was the true slave? The one who was being wooed, or the one who was doing the wooing? The one who pleaded, or the one who dismissed her plea? Indeed, there are boundaries set for slaves by God himself, and the extent to which one should obey them has also been determined, and going beyond them is wrong. Specifically, when your master orders nothing that displeases God, it is appropriate to comply and obey, but nothing more. For in doing so, the slave becomes free. But if you go beyond this, even if you are free, you become a slave. At least this is suggested when he says, "Do not let yourselves be the servants of men." But if this isn't the intended meaning, if he instructed them to abandon their masters and aggressively strive for freedom, how would we interpret his admonition when he says, "Let each one remain in the profession in which he was called"? And in another text, "All servants under the yoke should consider their own masters worthy of all respect, and those who have believing masters should not disdain them, because they are brethren who partake of the benefit." Also, writing to the Ephesians and to the Colossians, he establishes and enforces the same guidelines. Therefore, it's clear that he isn't nullifying this type of slavery. Rather, it's the kind caused by vice that also afflicts free men. And this is the worst type of slavery, even if the person in its grasp is a free man. For what gain did Joseph's brothers have from their freedom? Weren't they more servile than all other slaves, lying to their father, deceiving the merchants, as well as their own brother? But the free man was not like this. Instead, he was honest in every situation and in all respects. Nothing could subjugate him, neither chains nor slavery, nor the affection of his mistress, nor his alien status in a foreign land, but he remained free in every situation. For this is freedom in its truest sense, when it shines through even in captivity. Such is Christianity. It offers freedom even in slavery. Just as a body naturally invulnerable proves its invulnerability when it receives a dart and suffers no harm, so too a truly free person shows their freedom when they are not enslaved, even under masters. This is why the command is, "Remain a slave." If it's impossible for a slave to be a Christian as they should be, the Greeks will judge our religion as weak. But if they can learn that slavery does not hinder godliness, they'll admire our doctrine. If death, lashes, chains, slavery, fire, iron, countless tyrannies, diseases, poverty, wild beasts, and many things more dreadful than these haven't injured the faithful, but indeed made them stronger, how can slavery harm? It's not the condition of slavery, beloved, that hurts, but the true slavery is that of sin. If you're not a slave in this sense, be bold and rejoice. Nobody shall have the power to harm you, having the spirit that cannot be enslaved. But if you're a slave to sin, even if you are free 1,000 times over, you gain nothing from your freedom. So, tell me, what good is it if you're not enslaved to a man, but you're subjected to your own passions? After all, people often know how to show mercy, but these internal masters are never satisfied with your downfall. Are you a slave to a man? Well, your master is also your servant in managing your meals, taking care of your health and looking after your shoes and everything else. You don't fear as much about offending your master as he fears whether any of those necessities might be lacking for you. But he sits while you stand. So what? The same can be said of you and him. Often when you're lying down and sleeping soundly, he isn't just standing, but is facing countless troubles in the marketplace, and he stays awake more anxiously than you. For example, what did Joseph endure from his mistress compared to what she endured from her malevolent desires? Joseph certainly did not do the things she tried to impose on him, but she did everything that her mistress commanded, which is her unchaste spirit. This spirit did not cease until it exposed her to shame. What kind of master would command such things? What kind of brutal tyrant? Beg your servant, that's the command. Woo the individual you've purchased. Implore the prisoner. Even if he rejects you in disgust, continue to besiege him. Even if you frequently talk to him and he doesn't consent, lie in wait for a moment when he is alone and force him and become a subject of mockery. What could be more dishonorable or more shameful than these words? And if even these methods yield no success, then falsely accuse him and deceive your husband. Notice how shameful and cruel these commands are, how merciless and savage and frenetic. What command does a master ever place upon his servant, like those that her lust then imposed upon that regal woman? And still she dared not resist. But Joseph didn't experience anything of this sort, only things that brought him glory and honor. Would you like to see another man under strict commands from a harsh mistress and without the will to disobey any of them? Consider Cain, what orders were given to him by his envy. She ordered him to kill his brother, to lie to God, to sadden his father, to get rid of shame, and he did it all, and in nothing refused to obey. And why be surprised that over a single person this mistress should have so much power? She has often destroyed entire nations. For instance, the women of Midian captured the Jews, almost putting them in captivity. Their own beauty igniting desire was the means of their conquering that entire nation. Paul then, to eliminate this kind of enslavement, said, "Don't become servants of men." That is, don't obey men commanding unreasonable things. No, don't obey yourselves. Then, after elevating their mindset and making it ascend, he says, verse 25, "Now about virgins, I have no specific command from the Lord, but I offer my opinion as someone who has received mercy from the Lord to be faithful." Moving forward in a systematic manner, he next addresses the topic of virginity. After having coached and conditioned them through his discourse on self-control, he moves towards something greater, stating, "I don't have a mandate, but I deem it to be good." Why? For the very same reason he had specified concerning self-control. Verse 27. "Are you committed to a wife? Don't seek a separation. Are you separated from a wife? Don't seek a new wife." These words do not contradict what has been said before, but rather fully agree with them. For he also says in that place, "unless it be by mutual agreement," as he says here, "are you married to a wife? Do not seek a divorce." There is no contradiction here. For if the dissolution is against mutual consent, then it is a dissolution. But if both agree to live a celibate life, it isn't a dissolution. Next, so this doesn't seem like a new rule is being imposed, he adds in 1 Corinthians 7:28, "But if you marry, you have not sinned." He then brings up the current state of affairs, the present distress, the shortness of the time, and the affliction. For marriage brings with it many things which he has alluded to, both here and in the discussion about self-control. There, by saying, "the wife has not power over herself," and here, by the phrase, "you are bound. But if you marry, you have not sinned." He is not referring to her who has chosen virginity, because in that case, she has sinned. Considering that if the widows are condemned for engaging in second marriages after they have once chosen widowhood, this applies even more to the virgins. But these people will have trouble in their physical existence. And also pleasure, you might say. But notice how he minimizes this with the brevity of time, saying, "the time is shortened." In other words, we are urged to leave now and move on, but you are delving deeper. Even if marriage had no troubles, we should still strive for the future. But when it also has affliction, why add an extra burden to oneself? Why take on such a weight, when even after accepting it, you must treat it as if you do not possess it? For, he says, even those who have wives must be as if they do not. Then, after mentioning something about the future, he redirects his speech to the present. Some of his subjects are spiritual, like one is concerned about her husband's matters, the other about those of God. Others refer to this current life, such as, "I want you to be free from worries." However, even with all this, he leaves it up to their decision, because someone who, after demonstrating what is best, resorts to force, seems as if he did not believe his own declarations. Therefore, he rather draws them in by agreement and restrains them as follows. Verse 35. And this I say for your own benefit, not to trap you, but for what is proper, and that you may devote yourself to the Lord without distraction. Let the unmarried women understand that virginity is not defined by that one point alone, for she who is concerned with worldly matters cannot be considered a virgin, nor proper. Thus, when he said, "There is a difference between a wife and a virgin," he added this as the difference, and that which separates them from each other. And setting forth the definition of a virgin and her that is not a virgin, he names not marriage nor self-control, but the freedom from commitments and multiple engagements. For the issue is not in the cohabitation, but in the obstacles to a dedicated life. But if any man thinks that he is behaving improperly towards his virgin, here it appears he's discussing marriage. But everything he expresses pertains to virginity. He even permits a second marriage, stating, "only in the Lord." Now what does "in the Lord" mean? With chastity, with honor, this is required everywhere and must be sought, because without it we cannot see God.